Should start. Hi everyone, welcome. Hope you're safe and sound wherever you are and being careful and doing all the right things. These are unusual times. We have over 560 registrations and usually about 200 people log in because our time is about 7:30 Indian Standard Time when we start. And we've deliberately chosen this time because it works well in Africa, Europe, Americas, Asia. I know it doesn't really work that well for the Pacific, of Fijian, Vanuatu, Samoan, Australian, New Zealand friends, but they all know that once they register, they can access the recording afterwards. Having said that, some of our colleagues from Australia are actually online, I can see. Thank you for being awake so late at night, and especially in Australia on a Saturday night, to be awake so late to join a webinar is something because people are still partying. And our three panelists, you've already got their bios with your email. You got all the details. You have all the reports, the UNESCO report, ICOM report, NEMO report, the 2015 UNESCO recommendation material, and the ICOM Cultural Diversity Charter. And why ICOM Cultural Diversity Charter? Because diversity is a big issue in terms of what we're dealing with from the report. So you have all that material that's been uploaded, which you can freely download. We know that several of you downloaded, hope you had a chance to read them. So our discussion is going to center around not just the reports, but we have very eminent panelists. We have, well, that's wonderful. I mean, I always get across the border from Pakistan, wonderful greetings. And I haven't yet been to your beautiful country one of these days. I will be coming, so I look forward to it. So there are people from over 100 countries that participate in Heritage Matters webinars. Sometimes there's about 80, like this one, there's about 86, I think, countries that are represented through their participants. So it's fairly global, Heritage Matters. And one of our panelists, Lazare Yolundu-Asumo, Director of Culture and Emergencies at UNESCO Paris, he's going to join us soon. He's been held up because of a personal family reason, so he'll join us soon. But Dr. Alka Pandey, Professor Dr. George Abungu are with us. You have already got information about them. What usually do people do is with the panelists, they Google them. What I found with webinars and all these sort of things that are happening, people Google our panelists online, then they decide whether they want to join, whether they want to register. And that's wonderful. That means it saves us a lot of time. Now, getting back to the global situation that represented by UNESCO, who conducted a global survey through the state parties. There are 195 countries that are state parties of UNESCO. They did some very basic survey to establish a baseline data and statistical framework. And International Council of Museums, which is a professional body that's accredited as an NGO of UNESCO, have conducted a survey also through their international committees, networks, and individuals that they targeted as experts. So you see both of them. Then NEMO, the European Organization of Museums, they also did a survey. One would think it's largely focused on Europe, but they have had inputs from across the world, because there's a lot of people who are diaspora across the world who have a strong relationship with Europe. And I've also looked at a number of other reports which had to be translated because several other countries are doing reports as well. And what you find is three things have come out very strongly. Number one is the disparity, you know, in distribution of museums. Even if the statistics that are provided are the first round of information that we got from the surveys, both by UNESCO and ICOM, and also NEMO, but they give you a broader picture that, you know, something like 70% of the museums are located in, you know, in Western Europe, mostly Western Europe or North America. And there are, you know, at least 17 countries with no museums. And some of them had museums, but you got to remember, apart from the COVID-19 situation, people are dealing with climate emergencies, cyclones. If you take Vanuatu, it's had Namibicide, you know, sort of very bad cyclones, very badly affected. So they're dealing with all kinds of crises. But what comes across also is that small island development states, there's 53 countries which are called small island development states. They hardly, you know, very few of them have the infrastructure to engage in emergencies such as this. And also the other thing is that in 1996, when the UNESCO World Commission for Culture and Development published their report, Our Creative Diversity, I worked with the commission. We did a global survey of digital infrastructure. What we found at that stage is that the same kind of inequalities that we still find, it's just that what is different is, even though many more countries, many more museums have got digital infrastructure, in terms of content development, it's still dominated by some countries of global north. And so there are many countries of the global south which are trying to deal with this. Now, also research is showing, I mean, this is my own research I've been doing. Every webinar we do background research, that those museums in Western countries, like in New York and so on, which had digitized materials, very good digital infrastructure, which immediately went into the digital domain to with their online exhibitions, online collections, their circulation only lasted 5 days. After about 5 days, it went down dramatically because they might have all the resources, but they still need to engage with their audiences, their users, if you will. And that requires a different kind of capacity in the digital domain. Because when it comes to that digital domain, even the Metropolitan Museum, Museum of Modern Art, they can't compete with Netflix. So when people have a choice between Netflix and seeing an online exhibition, you know how people make their choices. So there's that digital engagement, which we still need to deal with on a global scale, especially with content development. There's been very strong emphasis on digitization of collections. And I often quote an old Muslim saying from Taj Ganj near Taj Mahal, where the Muslims say that a closed book is like a block of stone. So an artifact is the same, you know, so, and a digitized artifact or artwork is the same. If it's digitized, that's fine. But how do you open it? How do you access it? Digitization is only a means, but how do we access? How do we engage? These are critical issues that come up. And we are focusing on museums that are reopening. Thanks to their social media, they're able to tell us they're reopening, especially in Europe. But what about all those museums, which unfortunately may never reopen? I'm not talking about countries in global south. There are many museums in global north also, in rural parts of Nordic countries, for example. There are museums that are closing. Rural parts of Europe, there are museums that are closing. So will they ever reopen? I mean, this is a key concern that we have. And finally, I just want to make one comment from the research. I'm not going to take up more of your time. As people reopen, as people re-engage, I've looked at nearly 40 plus reports of countries, how they consider international diplomacy. Most countries are concerned about trade relations. Right? How do they engage? Because the borders are closed, they want to reopen the borders. How do they engage with trade relations? And culture, museums are seen as part of, and especially artists, creative industries, biennales, triennials, these are all seen as, you know, the classic so-called soft power. You know, we need to fund them because they open up doors for us. They create good relations with across the borders. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But that's what I'm finding. I've looked at 46 countries, how they're engaging, you know, international relations. And they're all taking the same line, is that how do we fund culture? And there are very few countries like Germany. Germany, the Chancellor and the Minister for Culture announced 50 billion euros over the coming years to rehabilitate the cultural sector, creative industries, museums across the board. And I tried to look at the German situation very critically, and I found that it genuinely is engaged with what UNESCO has been trying for so long, is about locating culture in sustainable development. So it's wonderful. Now, thanks to Germany, many countries also want to use the cross-border relations. And because of the nature of COVID-19, people are looking at cross-border, but not, you know, intercontinental, if you will. Like, I haven't come across many reports where they talked about, Europeans talked about engaging with Africa or Asia or India or Latin America. They're mainly talking about their own immediate borders to engage across, which is also understandable because that's the nature of the COVID-19 situation. Now, I've said enough to open up, and we're still waiting for one of our panelists who's held up with a family emergency, and he will join us very soon. But in the meantime, we'll start with Professor Dr. George Abungu, you from Nairobi, Kenya. George and I share two designations together. We both are former vice presidents of International Council of Museums. We're also both Salzburg Global Fellows, and from two very different parts of the world. And Professor Abungu, it's been such a pleasure to get to know you over the years and work with you. Would you please take over now the session?
Thank you very much, Amar. Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening. Good night. Well, it's a pleasure, a real pleasure to talk about the museums. And I think that you've summed up quite elaborately on the issues that are out there. For example, the documents that you have mentioned, particularly the ICOM document and the UNESCO documents that have come out on museums during the time of COVID-19. I think they are crucial documents. But I would like to start by giving sort of a critique of those documents. I would like to give a lecture. Basically, I would like to create a discussion. And by doing that, I would like to basically look at museums, what we do, and what kind of museum I would like to see in post-COVID-19, if there's going to be a post-COVID-19, because this seems to be something that may be with us for a long time. I think that the documents are important because they are giving us direction of what is happening, the challenges, the problems, the issues that we've seen that are facing museums. But at the same time, I think that, you know, these documents have been developed within a month. I think with ICOM, I think it's from 7th of April to 7th of May, developed somewhere from Paris, collecting information from a number of people. So it's basically hearsay from different individuals in different parts of the world. And when you come from the global south, sometimes information is, you know, is hard to come, takes time. And so I would say that I think that as much as the figures could be correct, they may not be all correct. The same with UNESCO, which is quite, I find, much more detailed. But just to mention what you said, or to critique what you said 17 countries don't have museums. These are the seed countries. I can tell you that two of those that I am very familiar with have museums that I have visited in the last probably 5 months or six months ago. And I was very surprised to see them in a UNESCO document. For example, when you say, I think Antigua, I think there is a museum of cricket in Antigua, if I'm not wrong. Also, when you go to St. Kitts and Nevis, if you go to Basseterre in St. Kitts, one of the iconic buildings actually holds a museum of St. Kitts. And in Nevis, you have two museums, the Hamilton Museum, which is named after Hamilton, the first Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of the United States, who was actually born there, and Horatio Nelson, who actually fought, you know, in these military wars with the French, and everybody knows about that if you read your European history. So two museums there, and these are classified as having no museums. So that's why I'm saying that the figures are wrong. But apart from that, what then do we have? Museum, because I think that the topic is basically on museums on post-COVID times. I would like to start by what I would want to finish with. And this is basically about the beauty of museums. I think that museums are beautiful because you can do anything in them and you can do anything with them. They are neither neutral nor are they truthful all the time, because a lot of it are constructs, things that we construct. And I think that is one of the beautiful things about museums. And I think secondly, because they are flexible. And I think if you take those particular characteristics of museums, then maybe we should not be worrying so much, but we should be thinking of how we are going to deal with museums in post-COVID, if museums are flexible and if they are capable of absorbing a lot of things beyond the definition of what museums are, this idea of flexibility. And so when we look at museums, there are different kinds of museums. There are different topics that are discussed in museums, ranging from politics, cultural issues, social issues, economic issues, health issues, historical issues. There are science museums that we barely talk about. And my worry is that in times of difficulties like this, when we talk about museums, we always go back to regurgitating the same stories that we have heard, which is basically museum as a place of identity, you know? I don't wait for the museums to define my identity. I know what my identity is, and I've had it so many times. And I think that when people hear museum as a place of identity, sometimes they get a little bit tired. There's also museum as a place of cohesion, national cohesion. Surely you can also have national cohesion even without museums. And in most cases, it's the politicians who decide whether they want the cohesion or they want to disrupt it. Museums are very important for education, but all those three, I see them coming now and now again. Now, if you compare that with what is happening in the sector of health or in the sector of economy, the language is very different. There's new language which is being developed at the time when things are happening. And I think that we are probably we are missing out on that. And yet museums are places where we can cover huge areas. Museums are very important for research, from humanities to social to hard sciences. I used to work in a museum that actually is known for doing research on very tough stuff like on malaria and HIV and other things. And currently they are actually involved in testing for COVID-19 in Kenya. This is the National Museums of Kenya through one of its centers called the Institute of Primate Research. So we can be able to expand and be able to sell ourselves much better, to move away from continuously regurgitating the same old things. So identity, cohesion, those are very common. Now I hear another language coming in, which I fear is going to also dominate which is called the resilient. This is another new terminology that the museums are taking in. So, you know, we are bringing in resilience between communities and all that. And I think that what we need to do is to try to develop a language that also in sync with the language of other sectors of the economy, other sectors of health, other sectors of society, based on community needs and so on. So what would I like to see after, if there is going to be after COVID-19? I would like to see some kind of transformation. And I have about three or four different areas that I would like to see in museums, whether it is in Germany, where you have mentioned, and I happen to be one of the international advisors of the Humboldt Forum, which I think is probably going to be one of the largest museums there. I know what they're doing, and I know they're spending quite a bit of money, but you can't compare it with the other places. Or you are talking about a small museum or in a village somewhere. What would I like to see? I think I would like to see a language of relevance. Things we cannot do without. For example, at this particular time, can we do without vaccination against COVID-19? What is the museum going to say about that? Do we have museums that are currently collecting in the subject of COVID-19 that they are going to be able immediately to put up exhibitions that are going to be educative to the people? Whether it is going to be digital or is going to be physical, doesn't matter. But are we doing that, or we are still waiting to be led somehow? Issues of rights that we tend to not touch so much. Looking at opportunities, you know, cultural rights, indigeneity, rights to decolonization. I know in the northern part, the word decolonization is something that is not very popular. But from where I come, this is a major issue. Right to equality. How are the museums dealing with that? And we have seen in the last few months the serious problems that have come even within communities. You know, men versus women, children and young girls and all that. Are we talking this language? Are we talking them the language? We've seen the race problems. What are the museum? Are the museums involved, going to be involved in this so that we can be able to stand up and say, like every other organization, we are also discussing the current situation, not just identity and national cohesion. And then the second one is the question of current, which I've just mentioned. You know, learn to adjust. The question of knowledge generation, new knowledge that is coming up, problem solving, how can we be involved in that? The third one is appealing. How do we appeal, for example, to the youth, to the women, okay? Against, to the people who are discriminated against, so that we move from the boundaries of heritage and collections as the core to dealing with issues that affect humanity. I think that we are so much absorbed in what we have collected in the past and forgetting what is around us. And I think this is what is going to move us out. When we discuss issues of SDGs, are we dealing with those things like that? Entrepreneurial kind of spirit, are we developing among the youth who have this knowledge, whether it is in art or it is in, you know, social media or whatever it is? Are we in that? These are issues that are very, very important. And lastly, I would like to see museums being much more provocative. We are not being provocative enough. We are being very polite, very sort of, you can even say naive, you know, because we always say, oh, I see when I read some of these reports, you know, museums are bringing national cohesion and identity, and they are drivers of local development. What does that mean? What is the driver of local development? How? Oh, that they are important for tourism. Of course, we know about that. But how do we provoke those who are sources, the exchequer, to say that the same with health, we as a museum are able to contribute equally to that national spirit that is going to fight against this particular disease, or that's going to develop beyond and build a better nation than even what we have had before the COVID came. So this is more or less a much more of a provocative talk. And I think that we'll be able to discuss more as we go on. I think I'll leave it at that, and we'll be more than willing to take part in the discussion afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Abungu. Much appreciated, and the eloquent way you hit the nail on the head. You know, sort of we need to confront the real issues. And I think the lockdown has given us an opportunity to be reflexive, reveal and confront, you know, the range of things that you've raised. And the question of relevance, you know, remains central to everything, as you pointed out. Now, let's hear from Dr. Alka Pandey. Alkaji, you're going to be hosting the world's first ever museum biennale. What do you see? What do you see as a site for the future museum biennale?
Namaste. Good evening to everybody. And big namaste from Delhi to all people who are outside India. These are indeed difficult times, and I hope all of you are healthy and safe. And we are talking of something which is really the most liminal of all spaces at this moment in time. Museums, arts, the creative industry is the one which is coming really last on the list of priorities for the entire world. Because the first thing is health and life, and then is livelihood. For most of us, except people who are really in the world of arts, who are, you know, we are all very passionate people. We are in the arts because not because it's skill development or livelihood. We are here because we simply love what we do. And we are very passionate about what we do. So this is something very, very important for all of us. But in the present times, for most governments, except say perhaps for Germany and New Zealand and some other countries in the white Western world, museums still have a budget and they still have a place where they are debating about it. But in a country like mine, where there is this whole problem of the utter abject misery of migrancy, of migrant poor, of people traveling thousands of miles barefoot in the sun, just wanting to get back home to their loved ones. Museums are somewhere really in a very esoteric space. However, museums are for all of us who are either talking about it or listening to it at the moment, they are very, very important and they are very much part of our central being after our life and food. Food, shelter, clothing is coming in first. But after that, museums are extremely, you know, very much part of our universe. I'm not even going to talk much about the what UNESCO is doing, what Professor George has just very, very eloquently expressed that some of the numbers are wrong because there are small countries who are doing museums. He's raised some very vital issues. Professor Gala has talked about the whole concept of, you know, what museums mean, and different interpretations have come. It's not just about identity. It's just not about communication. It's also should be a space of provocative ideas. But in India, museums first need to be inhabited. I'm not even talking of a post-COVID time. I'm talking of a pre-COVID time. I think being one of the oldest civilizations in the world, in India, you kick a stone and an archaeological object appears. You scratch a wall and an epigraphic site appears. So for us, our whole country literally is like a living museum. But because there is so much of it, I think we as a nation have really not given it the kind of importance it deserves. And I think to a large extent, it was our colonial masters who, whether it was Lord Curzon or it was the Education Act of 1854, or it was the setting up of the art colleges, culture and museums came into a kind of a structured way with our colonial masters. And then, of course, I would give a lot of credit to the Nehruvian vision of really bringing culture into also a kind of a national importance, because it was Nehru who said that every building in this country should spend 2% of its expense into art and culture, which has not happened till now, whether it is CSR. What is the problem with our museums is that they are actually mausoleums full of the most beautiful objects. And it always depends from time to time who is the individual who is heading that museum. In fact, with Professor Gala itself, he was setting up something fabulous in Amravati. And then there was a change of leadership and he had to move and leave behind this most beautiful community project which he was developing and the whole kind of immersive spaces that were being created. Because the new world today, the new world, and I do believe in that, is the immersive space. Because as Professor George said, we don't really need to know about identity. Most of us who are here discussing as well, we know what our identity, of course, is. We know what nationhood is. We know what nationality is. We know what sexuality is. We know what historical narratives are. We know what myths and legends are. But the most important thing is we have to understand what this wonderful country, the wonder that is India, has to offer. Now, as Professor Gala mentioned, that I am the project director for the Bihar Museum, for the Biennale, I was just lucky enough to get my toes, just dip my toes in the gold mine, which is there in Bihar, which not only talks of inclusiveness, but it has some of the most beautiful objects, including the world-famed Didar Ganjakshi, which talks of the femininity of what it is to be Indian. But where is that dialogue happening? Where is that dialogue happening between the object and the viewer? For me, that is very, very important. The whole concept of narrative, of storytelling, of understanding myths and legends of our country. And the museum is actually a laboratory of ideas from where, if you are situated, you interpret the object as you want it to. However, and I'm talking very specifically, and I want to talk also only from my whole trajectory of Indian museums. So we have 28 states and 9 union territories, and every state, every region of this country has one national government-run museum at the very minimum, and a host of other museums, private collections, private collectors setting up small little museums, and this is growing rapidly in our country. But with a country of 1.3 billion, what is really sad and distressing for me as an art educator, as an academic, as a person who's working with museums at the moment, is that, you know, it's not been introduced at the school and college level. Whereas you see in more developed or different societies, children are being taken to museums. We hardly see any children being taken to museums. Even in the Bihar Museum, which I see, it's so gorgeous. The building is so wonderful. Done none other by Fumihiko Maki. People are coming there for photo ops. But I say, okay, fine. Even if they're coming for photo ops, maybe some sculpture will register in their minds. But we need to populate the museums. We need in our country to get people coming into the museum, have a whole day, maybe once a month, maybe once a week. Every family should take it as an outing. When you go to Germany, I think Germany is one place which has really cracked the code for museums, whether it is the Documenta in Kassel or it's every 10 years, the sculpture project which happens in Munster, where the whole city of Munster becomes a living museum. So things like that need to be done. We need to take these precious objects to the people. Instead of the people coming into the museum, I would say maybe we should have pop-up museums even in a place like a mall, because we need not to make the museum a space of, you know, absolute sanctified space where people talk in whispers and people are scared to even, you know, look at an object because it's so precious. Also, talking of the pandemic, I do agree with both Professor Gala and Professor George when they say that virtual, yes, virtual happened with MoMA, with the Met, and then everything started falling. Virtual is a very good thing too, because it's another way of communication. But the preciousness of the object, I think, has become even more valuable because there's a huge loss, there's a huge translation, a loss of translation through the lens of the digital. The objects can look even more beautiful. They can look worse, but they do not really convey the rasa or that aesthetic experience which you have between the object and the viewer. And I think more important than even social, religious, political content of the museum is the personal kind of communion which is there with an object of art. Because it is about, life is about beauty. Life is also about upliftment. And I think in the COVID period, the pandemic, I call it the, you know, we have a word called Pathshala in Hindi. I call it the COVID Pathshala. I call it the COVID school, which has given all of us a lot of time to rethink, to reboot, to realign. And we realize that we need to be connected in also a physical way to whether it is an object of art. So while the digital is a very good thing, having virtual tours, telling people about what the museum is all about, that's very, very important, but it's one trajectory. What I feel is post-COVID, I think it is up to all of us to make that special effort to drive this whole project museum even stronger, because we are really way down. The economy the world over has collapsed. Money is not there. The ECOMOS report is just showing how fragile people are. People are being thrown out. There is, the big, big people who were donating to the museum will also not have money. But I'm sure the human spirit and resilience of all of us as humans is very powerful. The only thing is that we have to ensure that museums are interactive spaces. They are spaces of creative ideas. They are spaces which uplift our spirits. It's all about our mental health. And I think mental health, art, and beauty are equally important in post-pandemic times. And I think that is why museums become even more important, because what do they house? They house some of the most beautiful treasures of beauty. And I think beauty is very, very important at this time of our lives. I would end with that.
Thank you, Dr. Alka Pandey. Thank you. You so eloquently explained the current situation, but also positioning the museum as a space for interaction in a new way that we need to, especially in India. Thanks for mentioning Amaravati. One of the things that I enjoyed most over there is I used to take personal tours of not just the museum building, but the whole Amaravati heritage town of 300 acres. People had to walk 9.1 kilometers with me throughout the day with breaks to appreciate the what is an eco museum, what is an experience. And people were coming from not only all over Andhra, but also from Malaysia and many other countries, you know, sort of once they heard about it, it was quite amazing. But, you know, you made me think about my own past in Australia. I still remember in the late 70s and especially 80s when I was quite deeply involved in Australian museums, there were hardly any educational programs, there were hardly any school groups that they just came and left, there was no engagement. But I think that what in Australia we did was partnerships with the departments of education, ministries of education. So ministries of education, culture came together into a partnership to bring and enrich the school programs in Australia. So 90s was a transformative period for us. And I hope that we can do something like that. And also talking about statistics, I know Professor Bungu, you know, asked us to be wary of the statistics and all the reports. To read that, you know, in Australia alone, you know, you've got 38.6% proportionate to the population museums. In India, it's 0.4% for 1.3 billion people. Still points to, you know, a ground reality. And I think that we need to rethink those mausoleums. We need to rethink new museums in India. And thank you very much. And we all hope, you know, we all look forward to the Museum Biennale as being a site for inspiration, not just for India, but for globally, because it's the first ever Museum Biennale in the world. And so thank you for your leadership. Now, I see that Mr. Lazare Ilundu Asomo, the Director of Culture and Emergencies in UNESCO, has joined us. And Lazare is also responsible for the 1970 Convention on the Prevention and the Illicit Import and Export of Cultural Property, because the COVID-19 situation, there is a lot of illicit traffic that's taking place. And in fact, auction houses have been asked to remove objects, you know, by courts, because they have come from archaeological sites. And I myself, coming from Andhra Pradesh, can tell you that no Buddhist site is safe, because those Buddhist sculptures of the Amaravati School of Art are some of the most sought after in the world. So we have huge issues, and Lazare is also responsible for the convention. He's responsible for many other things, including the 2015 museum recommendation, which really brings all the state parties, all the 195 countries in sync with some kind of a shared understanding of museums and the possibilities. Now, Lazar, can I hand over to you? Could you provide your reflections, please?
Thank you. Professor Gala, and good evening to everyone from all over the world who are following this interesting debate and discussion. I think Professor Abungu and Dr. Alkapande have set the right tone on not only the meaning of the museums, but also, I mean, the fact that having faced the pandemic, we realized that museums today are even more important than before, and that museums are not only places of collections, and they have to play a much bigger role in the society. And this is also something that personally I was very privileged to experience 20 years ago, when for the first time I was lucky to be taught by Professor Abungu the way in Africa, you know, museums could play a much important role than only a place of housing collections. What museums could play in the society. And this is what is embedded in the 2015 recommendations of museums that was adopted by UNESCO. And this is what we need to promote. In fact, looking at the last report that UNESCO has issued, and I fully agree with some of the statements and comments that were made by Professor Abungu on the fact that maybe some of the statistics are not exact, but this is also one of the reasons why we will need to continue this work together with all the professionals and all the countries. What happened here is that when this pandemic happened, I think we started receiving many questions and the call for advices from the governments and member states on the fact that they wanted to be guided on how to go about this issue of museums. And that led us to immediately try to understand what was really the role of museums in the face of the pandemic. And one of the things that was important was, of course, to try to understand how museums have been adapting to this situation where everyone was more or less locked down. No visitors, no possibilities to enjoy the culture, to access the culture, and even to allow people and the world to continue promoting culture in general and allow museums to play their role in the society. So we decided to take up this challenge of conducting a study, which of course was a very quick study. It happened in a month, but sometimes it's important because at least you get a glimpse of the situation. You have a picture of the situation. And what I want to say here is that what was interesting for us to understand exactly if all the museums of the world have closed, what were the museum offering in this period? And what kind of actions, how can we, would we be able to advise governments and everyone on the fact that there is a risk for some of the museums in the world that have closed down not to reopen again. And that was one of the challenges. And this was the spirit in which we had to conduct it. And to understand what the museums, I mean, to understand why the museums and how many museums have closed, it was important at least to ask the question of how many museums the different countries have. And there comes the issue of understanding the statistics. And it was not an easy task to undertake because we did not get in such a short period, you know, all the answers that we needed. And I fully agree with the critics that these numbers needs to be revisited, and they will be revisited because if you all remember, we used to say that the world is having 60,000 museums, and this figure is dated from 2012. And this figure was completely outdated, and it was important to have an understanding of how the museums have evolved, you know, this past decade. And I think it also poses the question of the definition of the museums. When you speak to governments, when they give you their statistics, they give you what they have considered as museums or what they think the number is. And sometimes the numbers are not good, but these are the official's number. And of course, this needed to update it. And one of the tasks that we will be doing is to continue update the numbers. So for those who are listening to us and who goes through, if you have statistics that you would like to share with us in your different countries of what you think are the exact number of museums, please do share it with us. This is the first thing I wanted to say, and I count on everyone to do it. The second thought that I am having is, of course, on what we have observed in this report. First of all, that many museums, I mean, we have observed this word that Professor Abungu and Dr. Al-Kapande have been saying, that we need to use it with cautious, probably. But in a way, there has been a kind of resilience of museum, because museum have tried to continue being, you know, in contact with their public by trying to offer, you know, different experiences, although they were closed. We've seen it in some museums, but other museums could not do it. I remember having a discussion with the director of the Museums of Black Civilization, telling me that we cannot offer online virtual museums, because that's probably not the best way we are going to interact with our public. So we have to adapt also to our culture. So there has been many experiences. Some other museums have gone through social media experience, like in Latin America. In Africa, we have seen museums, you know, working with national televisions to offer programs. So there have been the variety, and it was important to try to capture them and to understand how this has been happening. So we can say that in the report, what was important to look at was to see that some of the museums, you know, reacted very quickly to this situation and tried to survive. But not all the museums will survive. And we know that, you know, there was, of course, this very difficult problem of the digital divide in the world. No one has this capacity of equipment and the technology, you know, to offer this. And even some of the museums who were able to offer this experience did it because they had already, you know, digitalized some of the collections that they had in the past. So it was easy for them, you know, to make them accessible to the public. The last comments that I wanted to make at this stage, Professor Gala, was of course on, you know, the future challenges. And I already mentioned the economic challenges, which is that because of the fact that some of the museums, I will say the small museums and others, you know, are not or were not able to continue, you know, getting some of the revenue for ticket entrance and many other possibilities might not open. And this is a reality. And I think if we see that in the last decade, there has been an increase at least of a minimum of 60% of museums. That means that museums are now recognized, like we have been saying, playing an important role in our society. If some of the museums have to close down, I think we should all be worried. We should all be concerned about this situation. We need to have this kind of the debate, which I welcome a lot. And the reason why I'm very happy to have this exchange is that we need to support museums, you know, to go through this difficult challenges and to overcome these challenges. And this is something which I wanted to say and at this stage. And we are, of course, I think in the course of the discussion, we will try to sit together. We have some ideas, of course, which I would like to share with you. And I'd like to stop there for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Lazar. Thank you so much. And thank you for your leadership and also the way you've been trying to bridge the global north and the global south and trying to mediate, you know, that those very difficult spaces. Really appreciate it. I, listening to you, you know, my memory went back to a very great museologist of India, who most people in India have almost forgotten, Dr. Saroj Ghose. He was a former president of ICOM, first, not just Indian, first Asian ever to become, or from Asia Pacific to become the president of ICOM. When he was the president of ICOM Asia Pacific, he started a project. He asked the National Committee of ICOM to publish a list of the museums in their countries. And then that effort should have continued, but unfortunately it hasn't continued. However, whenever we have an ICOM Triennial General Conference, like we did in Melbourne 98, 2004 in Seoul, 2010 in Shanghai, the hosts have published a consolidated list of all the museums in their countries. And I think there are many, you know, maybe a desk audit would help. I myself, I'm a founding trustee of Pacific Island Museums Association. I was involved in founding PIMA, the Pacific Island Museums Association. So we conducted for 17 countries, you know, brought them together, an audit of the museums, the range of issues that are there. I think that what your report has done and the ICOM report has done is galvanized us again. Hey, look, there's a lot of knowledge out there. We need to share. We need to bring it together. If we want to show solidarity and address the challenges, we need to do that. So I really appreciate, you know, sort of your inspirational presentation. Now we're going to get down to questions. Oh boy, there's so many questions. We might not be able to answer all of them, participants, but we'll definitely try to address as many as possible. And the first, Dr. Alka Pandey, the first questions are to you. With the Bihar Museum and the Museum Biennale, how are you planning to connect with marginalized communities? I mean, the question is relating to the kind of casteism and discrimination that's there in India, including Bihar. And can we make our responses short, please? Because we're running off, we've got half an hour. Alkaji, up to you. Dr. Alka Pandey, can you unmute? We can't hear you. Unmute, please.
Is that fine?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry about that. It's an important question, very significant, because in India, however rational we are becoming, however much of growth and development there is, however democratic we are, but you can't keep caste and class out in India. But I think in the cultural space, the liminal spaces are very, very interesting spaces. And a lot of people in the performing arts come from the edge of society in many ways, where caste is not even considered. But the Bihar Museum is a very, very democratic space. And we are going to try and thank God for the time we've got. In some ways, we have to also look at every positive aspect in adverse times. So we got another year, and we are going to try and spread as much information about the Biennale as much as possible through the virtual media, through social media, through posters, through districts, because this is a public museum. So we are going to get a lot of support from the government, and we are going to, all information will be in Hindi and English, so there will be a bilingual space. It's not going to be only English. The other thing is, we are also going to, in the verticals that we are doing over the 3 months of the Museum Biennale, we are going to get a lot of people from within the interior of Bihar also to participate. So the idea is to have a maximum outreach. It's actually Bihar, India, and the world, connecting cultures, connecting communities. That is the aim. So if we aim towards that, I'm sure even if we succeed 20%, it's a big beginning. And for that, we need the support of everybody who's also watching to spread the good word. We are open. We are open to ideas. We're open to being inclusive. We would welcome everybody to come to Patna.
Thank you, Dr. Alka Pandey. The argument is for collaboration and working together, not expect somebody on their own to do things. And that's something that we have to face in India, is we always expect government, somebody else will do things, you know, but we all need to be involved. And you mentioned something very interesting. You said most of the people in the performing arts area come from the edge, from the marginalized communities.
Yeah.
Those of you who are listening, I just want to point out the next webinar on the 4th of July will be focusing on subaltern discourses and Dalit engagement in India. And so the panelists are, one is a very famous theater artist, film actor, theater specialist. Another panelist is a poet, novelist, and also the third panelist is a very senior policy person dealing with Dalit situation in India. So all the three themselves, the whole panel comes from Dalit background themselves, and they're going to use their first voice to discuss. So please don't miss the next webinar. Now, there's a question here that I don't want to put it to the panel. Why is there so little digitization in India? We have such a large number of museums. I think that you go to the Ministry of Culture webpage and check it out and ask that question. I think that this is something we need to advocate with the government. Digitization, as I said in the beginning, is quite sad in India in a way, because 25% of the software engineers in the entire world live in India, you know, or they come from in India. In fact, in the Silicon Valley, IT stands for Indians and Taiwanese, because they stand for 68% of the software engineers in Silicon Valley. Yet, our museums and digitization, it's remained a challenge. I'll leave it at that. The next question again is to Dr. Alka Pandey. Why don't we have online Indian art, Indian painting courses on platforms like Udemy and Coursera? So many Western universities are offering courses on Asian painting. Why aren't we doing it in India? And Turkey is doing it on Byzantine art. China is doing it on Chinese art. When will we get a detailed Indian art course online in India? So Dr. Alka Pandey, do you want to briefly answer that?
Well, I think, Professor Gala, I want to throw the ball in your court. You are with the university. Why don't you start it? I'm happy to start it, but, you know, we do need a bit of an infrastructure. And I do agree with this question. Why are there no courses on Indian arts, aesthetics, culture, and heritage? It sets me thinking. And if all goes well, maybe I will start it in a couple of months myself.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the idea.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, thank you for the question and the idea. Okay, now the next three questions are all addressed to Professor George Abungu. Do you think museums are selling themselves short? How do we make productive connections that are mutually beneficial with communities? And how do we make museums relevant? All the three are clustered together. Professor Abungu. Professor Abungu, can you...
Thank you very much. I'm there.
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Those are very, very important questions. And it will take us away from India. I know that we are having this hosted in India, but I think there's quite a lot of concentration on that. So I'll move away, Amar, a little bit to the other part of the world.
Fantastic.
Yes. Now, the question of community, if I start with that, which is something that is very close to my heart. I think that museums do talk a lot about community, but if them who are their communities, they can't tell you, except if you come to Africa or go to South America, because the community element of the museum started in those two places. And that's why I tend to move away from giving examples of best practice being in Europe, because I think there have been some very good best practice in Africa, in Asia and South America that Europeans should be able to learn from. And one of them is community. Now, how have we done it? By symbolically destroying these walls that divide the museum. Because the way we are talking here is as museum is something that is within four walls. From this part of the world, we have always believed since the 1990s that for us to be able to deal with the community, to be able to be relevant to the community, we must break these walls. So we have to take the museum to the community. And I think this brings us back to the question of definition, because the way it is defined, museum is a permanent institution in the service of community, mm-hmm. that is this and that and that. That is a disservice. And I'm sorry, I'm a very faithful member of ICOM, but in this case, I tend to disagree with them in terms of their reluctance to move away from this passive definition to a more active definition that involves the community and puts the community in the center of the museum performance. I think that we can only do that if we relate the collections to the benefit of the community. That is one. Secondly, people have talked, and we talk about this, and when you read all these documents, we talk about numbers. Oh, we are 5%. Oh, we are some 80%. I don't believe in numbers. I believe in quality. I believe in the service. I believe in responsibility. I believe in accessibility, and I believe in relevance. Even if you have a few museums, but they go to the community. You don't need to have museum in every village, but you can have few museums, and as long as the accessibility to the community is there, then the museum will do its job. Otherwise, it becomes, you know, just a question of numbers. And I think that this is where sometimes we go wrong. So I think the question of community is key to the museum. The questions of accessibility, of responsibility, of relevance, of quality, of service, these for me are crucial for me to the museum. And thirdly, is the question of accountability. Most museums are funded by taxpayers' money. But how do we account for this? It's only probably in the part of in Africa, in South America, that we actually are called upon, and probably Asia, but now I hear in India is a little bit difficult, where we are called upon to account. But even there, I'm not saying that we are successful. There's still a long way to go. There have been some very good examples of museums through public programming, going out to the community, engaging with the community, and demystifying the question of museum as a four-walled structure with great, you know, collections that you have to go into as a temple, but really going out there and in the process engaging the people and making them become part of the museum and creating what we call that cohesion. So I think I'm answering your question in a more round way, but what I'm trying to say that for us to be able to engage with the community and to feel that we have the community, we must be accountable, we must be accessible, we must be relevant, and we must have quality so that when we leave the community, there is something that they say, yes, this does touch us. And lastly, that we must do it with the community rather than for the community.
Thank you, Professor Abungu. Very eloquently answered. You just reminded me of a current exercise that I seem to forget mentioning, that I'm undertaking. All my life, I've worked on eco-museums, as you know, and I've been in contact with several eco-museums that I've been directly or indirectly engaged in on three different continents. And all of them have reported that there's not a single case of corona positive or death. And the question has come back, why is that? Why is there a consciousness of public-private spaces? Why there is that solidarity in the community to deal with crisis? How can eco-museology actually, you know, play an important role? And like you said, it's with the community, eco-museums, as you know, some of the participants know quite well, is with the community. So thank you for underlining, you know, that key non-negotiable, if you will. Now, the next question, there's several questions from the Caribbean and many Africa, different countries that are coming through, but they're all focusing on one thing that is relevant to that could be addressed by, gosh, there's so many questions, they're moving down fast for me. To Lazar, these questions are addressed to you. The whole question of can the pandemic be provide a space for people in museums of the North to think about the collections that they have got from colonial times and more recently through illicit traffic to return them to Africa? And is this an opportunity because those collections reflect the resilience of the community spirit? So what can UNESCO do? What are the possibilities through UNESCO, through a deliberate recommendation to Western countries to use the window of COVID-19 to return the artifacts that are useful to rebuild and also cause dialogue for the future society? So, Lazare, over to you.
Thank you. This is a very interesting question that I'm having. Let me first start by saying that, of course, what this pandemic has, revealed is that people realized that they are even more and more, attached to the promotion of the cultural diversity, the promotion of their culture, and the understanding of their culture, because it had made them even more resilient, as we have seen during the pandemic. Of course, let me first also say that, yes, when it comes to interacting with museums, and probably museums of the North, like museums in the South, or museums in the Caribbean and everywhere, because UNESCO is working for all the museums in the world, not only the museums in the North or the museums in the South. Our position is very clear. UNESCO is for the promotion of return and restitution of cultural properties to their countries of origin. I think maybe it hasn't been clear, it's clear, and this position has been clear since 1978. When we created, the organization created the International Intergovernmental Committee for the Promotion of Return and Restitution of Cultural Properties. But the role of UNESCO is to promote dialogue, is to encourage dialogue among the different countries to ensure that the object are not only returning to their countries, but they are safeguard, but they also serve to educate and to continue be playing the role that they have been playing in the society in the past. And we have to do it. And that's the reason why, for this particular thing, the role of UNESCO in the future, and when I say in the future, in the aftermath of the pandemic, and it's something we have been discussing about, it's really to continue engaging museums from the North and museums from the other region to really take up this discussion together and collectively see how they can look at this issue of return restitution. And one, the first thing that will be to first know exactly what pieces is located where for all of the countries, because today there are certain countries who probably haven't done this first exercise to know exactly where the pieces that they think are in the museums in the north are exactly located. I think this work is extremely important to be done. The second one, of course, is that we should support wherever it's not, it doesn't exist, you know, the establishment of policies, because you can't deal with issues of protecting cultural object, of protecting them from looting and everything, if you don't have appropriate policies and measures to protect them. You don't to put in place law enforcement, which is important, to develop your museums. So these policies are needed. And our role is to help, you know, the different countries from all over the world to build those policies. The other thing that is important is to create cooperation between the museums in the north and the museums in the south and all the regions. We need to work together because it's a collective actions. We have been in a collective fragility of the world. I think we need to work together now, because it's only together that we can overcome some of the difficulties. That's one of the lessons that we have learned from this. So the last one is that we need to share our knowledge together, our good practices. Where there has been good practices of return or restitution of objects from museums in the north to the south, we need to learn from these lessons, because it will help also other try to replicate the same initiatives. But definitely, when it comes to the position of UNESCO, we have to promote this, because these objects are important for understanding the identities of the people, for understanding their civilization, for understanding the role that they have played in building our humanity. So we need to protect, to promote it.
Thank you, Lazar. I think you pointed out the policies. This is something that, you know, several of us have been saying for so long. Do you have a National Museum policy? Yes, you're a state party to the 1970 convention, but what operational procedures have you put in place? So it's on a lighter side, when I was ICOM president for Asia Pacific, thanks to both the Dutch and Swedish CEDA, I ran for 49 countries along with Etienne Clément from UNESCO. We used to do this jointly. Capacity building programs with museum professionals, UNESCO participation, Interpol, and world members from the World Customs Organization. But what we found is that this needs to be sustained. It's not like doing it for 3 or 4 years or 6 years. I think countries have to take more responsibility for this. State parties, a lot depends on them. And this is where policies become important. Unless there are policies, what I've noted, especially in the Asia Pacific, is a good policy helps to secure appropriate budget. Without policies, governments do not even think about, you know, budgetary considerations. So thank you for pointing that out. Now, the next one, we have so many questions here. Several of them are actually comments, so I'm going to, you know, acknowledge them. But the next one is to Professor George Abungu. Now, thank you for saying, highlighting that it's no longer business as usual for museums. And this has to be addressed. This is Professor Abungu, you know, your own establishing museum studies programs, you know, in different parts of the world. And more recently in Mauritius. This should include curriculum development aligned to the thinking, you know, to to minimize graduates still thinking along the traditional mindset of the museum. And so when is this a time, that's the question, is this a time for us to rethink, through the curricular development approach, museums as business entities with social corporate responsibility to local communities? Professor Abungu.
I think that question has an answer already. It does. I think the days when museums just sat on and felt that they were important entities in the community because they provided this so-called identity and national cohesion is gone. The world is moving very fast, and they have to always be alert to account for every coin that they get. And you can only do that if you are actually involved in issues that touch on current issues. And I'm not belittling the role of museums with its collection as key in understanding our being as humanity. I have grown up in the museums, I've taught museums, I consulted in museums, and I love museums. But I also think that sometimes we tend to sit and feel very self-satisfied with whatever we have, so that we do not look into other areas of how we can improve. So I think that developing capacity is crucial. Training at university level is crucial. I mean, for example, why are we not having so many, universities providing museological studies in Africa, in Asia, in South America? Why do we have to go to Leicester or somewhere else to study that and carry the same mentality and thinking back to where we come from, where the cultures are totally different? I think that it's not bad. I mean, I also trained in the North, but then I have to translate what I have learned and fit it within my own, situation. And as Lazar was talking about, the issue of return, some of these collections that you have there are actually not collections. Some of them are human beings. I mean, human remains. They call them collection in the North. We call them people. So that kind of stuff needs to be looked at very carefully. Some of these collections are very important spiritually to us. Now, if you are going to train people who understand this, who can negotiate with the North, they need to know the point of view of the North, and they need to know the point of view of the South. And I think that in the curriculum in the South, we should include both the thinking of the North and the thinking of the South. And I saw someone mentioning, and I did mention this issue of decolonization and museum as part of this. Whether we like it or not, the colonial era is not gone. There is, and some people even in the North still think that they are much more superior to those in the South. And I think that museum has a crucial role because as a laboratory and as a stage of performance, museums need to provide an agora for discussion in issues that include the question of decolonization. And the question of return and restitution for me is an agenda that is still pending from colonial time. So it is deeply a decoloniality agenda. And we need to be able to train our students in the South to understand these fundamental issues, some of these issues that they will not be able to be taught up in the Northern Hemisphere. So I
thank
agree.
Thank you, Professor Abungu. I think enough time for two quick questions. There's so many questions from different parts of Canada. I don't know how I'm going to take them on. But there's one from the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago, which I'm going to make the last question because it requires all of you to address it. But there's two questions from Canada. One is, how can or must museums adopt, this is to you, Lazar. Lazar, it's to you. Must museums adopt in order to become effective catalysts of local global cultural adaptation in order to create a global cultural pluralism and equity that's sustainable on the planet? Lazar?
No, thank you. Well, I think this question could be answered by Dr. Panda and also Dr. Pandey or Professor Abungor yourself. I think, let me first start by saying that Professor Abungu said it right from the beginning. I think, and Dr. Pandey also said it, museum should be more inclusive. This is the right word. I think we have seen that to deal with the challenges of the aftermath of the crisis, we museums would like to look at the different ways that it used to be in the past to engage and continue to engage with the public and to look at the new trends of the society. And many policies will have to be revisited to also, you know, facilitate and allow this to happen. There is already one step that we have achieved is through this discussion, where we are looking at this sort of questions. And we all agree today that, and Professor Abungu said it better than me, I like to use his words, it's that museums have to go beyond what they have been established for in terms of their mandates and their missions. And the many governments would like to understand it. And that's also the role of UNESCO to promote this. And one last thing is that I realize personally, because of this crisis, that, you know, this exercise that was done in the past to establish this museum's recommendations, it's so important. And we need to revisit this because some of these principles will definitely help the many museums of the world, the many professionals' museums, to position the role of museums today, you know, in light with what we are expecting the museums to play. And these principles are very important. They cover everything. They cover communities. They cover the importance of education. They cover the importance of the scientific research. They cover the importance to look at the global challenges that the society is facing. And I think all this together needs to be transformed into, or I'll say, into the policies that needs to be put in place. And this is what we would like to do. And I also think that this discussion is going to be introduced, you know, among the member states within UNESCO in discussing the future programs of the organization, so that we can the museums can play a more important role and can have a more important place in the cultural policies that countries will have to update or revisit after the pandemic. If you remember, in April, there were 140 ministers of cultures met online to discuss with UNESCO on the impact of the crisis on culture. And you will not be surprised that museums was mentioned so many times as something important to safeguard, to ensure that whatever happened in the future, you know, their role that we have seen in terms of their resilience and the way they have been engaging and the way the public and the communities have been requesting museums to continue be engaged makes them even more important than only looking at some of the few things like looking at the world heritage or looking at tourism issues, because museums are about people. Museums are about not only identities, and I agree with George, but museums are about people. Museums are about the future of the people, the future of the countries and their culture. So that's how I see it.
Thank you, Lazar. One last question that you might all want to briefly address. I'm trying to combine a question from Trinidad Tobago and from two parts of Canada. The question is that tourism and museums, they're so deeply interconnected. You know, what is going to be the post-pandemic situation? But closely associated with that is this whole notion of public-private civic museums, you know, the public-private partnerships, which have become popular within the tourism framework for museums in many places. Are there going to be new models that we could scope post-pandemic? Can each one of you answer that, please? Yeah. Lazaro, you go first.
No, what I want to say first is that I think it will not be fair to reduce museums and tourism. And I think the discussion that we have been having today show that museums will continue to play their role beyond the tourism purpose. Because tourism is about those who are coming to have an experience, and only in the experience that museums are offering them through the collections and the exhibitions that they are offering or some of the events, but it goes beyond it. So, and I think this is the most important thing, is that museums should also continue to play their role for the benefit of the communities, with the communities. And this is where it becomes important, because in the lockdown, there were no tourists. But museums continue to play their role. Museums continue to look at the society. So this is, I think, if this paradigm shift is done, it will be very good for museums to really position themselves in the society.
Thank you, Lazar. Professor Abungo, would you like to comment?
Thank you very much. You can hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, I think we need to understand what is meant by this. I understand from where the question comes from, particularly if it's a small place. What do we mean by tourism and tourists? Must tourists always be people from outside? Can't we have domestic tourism? So for me, we need to develop that element of domestic tourism. One thing that we learned from where I come from, Kenya, we had problems sometime in 2007, political problems. And before that, most hotels used to prefer foreign tourists. But then we went through a lean stage where there were no foreign tourists, and they went domestic. And as I said, today, most of those hotels, except during this pandemic, the domestic tourists are even more than, foreign tourists. So tourism will always be connected, but it depends on what you mean by tourism. But as Lazar says, I think we should also not tie it so much to tourism. But I look at locals also as tourists, and they can visit different parts of the country. And that's why I was saying, for me, the numbers is not the issue, it's the quality. So if you have a few museums in different places, you will actually encourage people to go and move if they have good products. On the question of private public partnerships, I think that is very important. And I think that museum should be going that way. The same way with this social responsibility. I think that we need to see more private investment in museums. We need to move away from seeing museum as dependent only on government. And when Lazar said, when you ask state parties about the number of museums, of course they only know the museums that they support, but there are also other private museums that are not counted. So I think that we need to promote also the private sector, and I like Mauritius for this. The majority of museums in Mauritius are actually run by private companies like the post office, like the sugar plantations and all that. And I think that we need to start going that way so that we can really start to appreciate community museums, where communities set their own museums. That has got nothing to do with the government. And so that we need to look at this this in a very different way, but we must tackle the definition of museum. The museum must be a flexible thing that fits everybody. That is when we will talk about inclusivity. But as long as we restrict it to some definition that, you know, sort of, you know, provides, gives sort of others much more clout and much more kind of, you know, status than others, then it's a problem. All these are tied together. So for those two questions, those are my comments.
Thank you, Professor Abungu. Dr. Alka Pandey, you deal with a lot of these issues of public-private partnerships. The Museum Biennale itself, to me, is a model that you're developing. Could you have the final word, please? Thank you.
Gosh, final sounds really final. But I would like to say that first and foremost, I would like to begin with the idea of the museum as being a wonder house. In India, in the old days, it was called an ajaib ghar. So if it is a wonder house, it just attracts people. I want the museum to be defined as a place which is extremely seductive, attractive, and of course, things are changing. Private, public partnership is a good model, but it is not the only model. Public museums are also important because it's actually within India, the big chunk of money comes from the government and they can afford to have low pricing to enter the museum. The most important thing, the word which I'd like to use and depend on or lean on is called creative business. And I think it is wonderful also to link tourists, whether they are domestic, international, I'd just say visitors to the museum should be increased. And there should be models, financial models, which make the museum an independent body. Because it's very important for anything to be cost effective. The minute you start depending, whether it's on a private corporate, whether it's on the government only, but if it you also involve the community, because it's not very difficult to make anything cost effective. If the product is good, if your museum becomes a wonder house, it becomes a must go place or the go-to place whenever anybody is coming into the city, it's about numbers. So with numbers, you can also make it economically viable. The actual bottom line for everything is the commercial viability. And there are always different models, and human beings are extremely inventive, innovative. There are different startups, the young people. In fact, we should involve a lot more young people, because museums actually in my country are very boring places where crusty people are at the helm of affairs. Why not have younger people taking ownership in some museums, you know, kind of make it a graph, as we were talking yesterday, you know, you need all kinds of people, old people, young people, old horses to guide, young horses to ride. So why don't we get younger people involved? They have different ways of, you know, getting people in. And I think museums should be wonder houses. And public, private, or just private, or just government, let's have all models working. And that is the inclusiveness of it all. And things, as Lazar said, as Professor George said, things are moving. And they're moving very fast. And we have to all work together. We have to be inclusive also of ideas. And I think we should just close the chapter on the past and all what the colonial masters did. We now move forward. We are all very, very confident people, whether it's a small island, whether it's a huge country, whether it's a developing world, emerging world. I think with the digital, we've all become extremely empowered, and startups, ideas are no longer only in the developed world. Sometimes the greatest revolutions are happening in the margins, and smaller countries are coming out with great inventive ideas. That's all what I'd like to say.
Thank you, Thank you, Dr. Alka Pandey. We've gone 15 minutes over, but thank you so much, all the panelists and all the participants for your questions. I see a large number of them are still engaged with us, and their messages coming from all over the world to say thank you, Dr. Alka Pandey, Professor Abungu, Lazar, all the three of you. Thank you for your time and thank you for engaging in this very meaningful discussion. One interesting comment has come from United States. The comment from United States is the one that I want to close this session. He said, oh, 4th of July, remember I mentioned the next webinar, Heritage Matters webinar, focuses on subaltern discourses and Dalit engagement in India, that all the panelists themselves represent Dalit literature, creativity, theater, acting. And so someone from US has sent a message saying, oh, that's 4th of July is very important day for US. Yes, that's exactly why we are planning it, because Black Lives Matter. That's exactly what we're planning. It's not just in the US that Black Lives Matter, they matter everywhere in the world. And for us, they matter in India with the Dalit communities. In Australia, I'm an Australian, very strong Black Lives Matter movement in Australia. So that's exactly, thank you whoever sent that message from the US. You're absolutely right, 4th of July, as you celebrate, we also want to discuss, you know, what is inclusion? How do we engage with subaltern discourses? And it's not just Dalit, but it's actually Black Lives Matter. Thank you very much. Thank you to our panelists. I really appreciate all of you joining us. And the recordings will be uploaded early next week on the web. And also in all the emails, you got a link to the documents. If you haven't been able to download them as said, because you're busy like all of us are, please do, because they're quite useful, those documents, and actually provide a backdrop for this conversation. The second thing is that there is a link there to onmuseums.com. This is the International Research Network on the Inclusive Museum. Those of you who are not familiar, the whole Inclusive Museum movement was founded through two streams, confluence of two streams. One is the UNESCO Universal Declaration on Cultural Diversity and its action plan that was adopted in the Rio Plus 10 Sustainable Development Meeting in Johannesburg. The second one is the ICOM Cultural Diversity Charter that was adopted after 20 years of work. It started in Quebec City during an ICOM Triennial General Conference, and finally it was adopted. It took that long to get some shared understanding, get all the members of ICOM to agree, and it was adopted in 2010 in Shanghai. It's called the ICOM Charter on Cultural Diversity, adopted in Shanghai. So, but all of these things in many ways come together under the 2015 recommendation of UNESCO and the way it's being taken forward. What I love about recommendations is that they're not hard law ones, like World Heritage Convention is hard law. You know, there's compliance, there's a whole range of things. With soft law, as we call it, the 2015 convention provides that kind of flexibility that Lazar was talking about, Professor Abungu was talking about, Dr. Alka Pandey was talking about, the transformations and the flexibility that's possible. So they can all be downloaded. We've provided you the links. Once again, thank you to all the participants and the panelists. Thank you for your time. Goodbye for now.
Thank you to you, Professor Gala, for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, okay. Professor Abungu. Keep well.
You too, all of you, keep well, be safe wherever you are. I think our host will have to end the session because there's so many participants still online, they don't want to go. That's wonderful, but please join us on the 4th of July, same time on the 4th of July, Saturday. because we will talk about representation through literature, creativity, and museums as well. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for joining. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. I'm sorry.
Good night.